Group meeting, Friday, 15th January, 1982. The question is, should one wait till one has sorted oneself out spiritually before joining in doing good works? I'll read the question again. Should one wait till one has sorted oneself out spiritually before joining in doing good works? I think it is a very good question. And the questioner is sensitive and perceptive. Putting a question like that means business and is serious-minded. So the question really deserves very careful consideration. Perhaps we might start by inquiring, why do we want to do good works? Perhaps there is a pleasure drive involved in it, because it gives one pleasure. But if it is something which gives one pleasure, then if one joins some group, because the question does say, before joining in doing good works, and there are people in the group who are not in sympathy or would contradict what the person wants to do, there would be displeasure involved and trouble. And this happens so often in life, doesn't it? We know from our own living experience. So, obviously, if it is a question of a pleasure drive animating the person, then it is wise to wait until one is sorted out. Another point, one may have a genuine personal interest in the particular type of good work. You see, a personal interest in it. But here many curious things will arise. If one has a personal interest, there is the problem of ego satisfaction involved in it. If one satisfies one's own self-esteem thereby, that quality will invariably and inevitably spoil the good work, even if it is only in a small degree, but it will spoil it. Because the introduction of self-interest always spoils a good work. Of course, we are looking at this not from the ordinary everyday practical point of view or everyday practical affairs. There it is different, you see. If it is something, say, of a religious nature, a social nature in the profound sense of social, then self-interest, which is an unsocial energy, unsocial quality, will inevitably spoil the work that is being done. So we have to beware of the element of ego satisfaction. I am sort of trying to look into the sorting out process, you see. And if there is ego satisfaction involved, there is, of course, power gratification. One's desire to dominate, to control that which is regarded as outside oneself comes in. The very fact of regarding the work as outside oneself is something which spoils the work. Because wherever the self, selfness, in any shape or form, enters into the situation, it spoils the situation. One has to see in committee meetings and various social situations how this, the person who has a strong sense of ego, will talk all the time and sort of outdo the other people speaking. One notices that everywhere. People are not quiet. And the person who is not quiet is not going to be someone who is really going to do good. There are those people who are constant chatterers, absolutely non-stop chatterers. One can see this in social meetings as well, but of course there it is a slightly different situation. They are not concerned with doing a good work, but even in those cases where people meet to consider some good work which has to be done, you will find them talking at the same time. Why they can't shut their mouths and be quiet inside themselves is really incredible. And educated people, you'd never expect them to go to that limit. But there they are, always talking. And in that talk, there will be a considerable introduction of the self. I think, I did, I spoke to so-and-so, etc., etc., etc. It is this poisoned barb of selfness which spoils it all. So, ego satisfaction, power gratification, dominating the social group, all these elements have to be borne in mind. If they are there, it is better not to touch it, because that touch will besmirch the real good. Then, of course, there is the situation where one wishes to do good or attempts to join in good works because of real compassion for those in suffering. And, of course, especially in our modern world, there is so much suffering everywhere. Suffering born of our own greed, fear, violence, and perhaps worst of all, stupidity. So much suffering. And out of compassion, one would like to join in doing good works. Of course, the absence of selfness is obvious in those who join in good works because they cannot help but do it. That is the least amount of selfness involved in that. They cannot help doing it. They are like that, you see. The person with natural good manners, for instance, you drop your handkerchief and he'll pick it up and it'll be in your hands and he'll be off and you won't even know who did it. You see, that sort of cannot help doing the right thing. But if it is a case of compassion for those in suffering, then we have to consider these points. Have we real understanding and ability to do the good work? There are so many people who rush about doing good work, as they would say, but actually they are a pest, they are a nuisance. And they are always making you sign on the dotted line or getting 10, 20, 100, 1,000 pounds out of it. And they measure their goodness, the goodness of their work, by the size of the check. One has to beware of that, absolutely. So we must inquire, have we real understanding of what this good work is about? And we have to question ourselves, have I any ability, real ability along these lines? And if I have real ability along these lines, I must also inquire whether I can utilize my ability in this group without imposing myself. It's extraordinary how people will be constantly blowing their top off, saying what ought to be done and this, that and the other, and dictating to others. But have I the real ability to do it? If I haven't, let me be quiet. Otherwise, I only spoil things. People don't realize to what extent they spoil things. We blame others. We blame organizations. We blame politicians, economists, shopkeepers, the whole lot, whatever they are. You see, it's that person does this, this group does that, these people are left, these people are right, these people are upside down, and so forth and so forth. We always throw the blame upon others, which is only evidence of how very self-centered and egoistic we are. And vain. We satisfy our egoism and vanity most of the time. I remember very well one of my very dear friends from Cambridge. He was my contemporary at Trinity. He first became a solicitor in his father's office. It was an old established firm. But he had quite a flair for finance, and he ended up as the chairman of Army and Navy. And we used to meet fairly frequently and talk about things, and he had a good philosophical mind and outlook and so forth. And I asked him one day from his whether he could tell me out of his experience, if people were devoid of egoism and vanity, how much of the business world would survive or disappear? You know, he had a habit of the smoking, always holding the bowl of the pipe, considering a thing very carefully in his mind, the trained lawyer, you see, and then just saying what he thought. And he said, he always called me by my initials. So he said, PM, I think about 95% of the business world would disappear if people were devoid of ego and vanity. 95% of the business world would disappear. Now that's very significant, isn't it? It just shows how a very practical, capable, sound businessman of the world could say a thing like that. I mean, he had tremendous experience. I know he used, when you're chairman of Army and Navy, this is just soon after the war. Checks of 6 millions, 10 millions would be signed by him. This man who was accustomed to do that sort of thing had to be a very responsible person. So there we are. And we must inquire where our real understanding is concerned of the good work. What is the good? So many people think, oh, this is a good thing, let's do it. But is it? Is it a real good? Is not this cottoning on to a particular thing a fragmentation of the whole, taking it out of the context of the whole? And when you take something out of the context of the whole of life and the whole procedure, you are always partial. You can never be impartial. And the intelligence and skill which you can put into that work will also be something which promotes partiality and separateness. This is where a deep problem lies, because it is directly related to the whole question of sorting oneself out spiritually. So we have to inquire, what is the good? And in relation to the good, one can see holistically, in depth, and with great sympathy and compassion, what is required with respect to the particular organization. Of course, there are situations which arise which need immediate action. You can't wait to sort of philosophize about it and so forth. Immediate action is required. And yesterday and this morning on TV, one saw how that man jumped into the ice-cold Potomac and saved the life of that woman. Now that was immediate action, which was necessitated by the nature of the situation. And a complete stranger, he just did it. If I jumped into the ice-cold water of the Potomac, that would be the end of me, because I couldn't survive that sort of thing. Certainly now. I remember very well, in my second term in Cambridge, an undergraduate who became a very, very close friend of mine, he was a good swimmer, and he came to me, this was February, remember, and he said, would you like a little dip in the Cam? We'll have a little swim. I, being completely ignorant of what happens in ice-cold water, because all I knew about swimming was in Colombo, where the temperature of the water is round about 75 to 80 normally, you see. So I said, righto. And we went, and he thought that I was all right, that I knew what the cold water would be like. He didn't know that I didn't know. So he jumped in first, And about 5 seconds later, I followed suit. It's a marvel that I'm alive to tell the tale. Because the cold gave me such a tremendous shock. And I hadn't braced myself for it. If I had braced myself for it, it would have been different. Remembering that experience, up in Kashmir in 1934, at a height of about 11,000 or 12,000 feet, there was a beautiful lake, the shape of a figure of eight, absolutely blue, wonderful blue skies, and a brilliant sun. And remembering that experience, I knew what to do. So I sat upon a rock and dipped my feet in the cold water, took them out, dipped them in, took them out, went deeper and deeper that way, till my whole body was really warmed up, quite warm. And then I plunged in. Even so, I just swam about 8 or 10 yards and came back. And when I came back, it was so marvelous a feeling, I just shouted for joy. Nobody was there, you see, right up at that height in this lake. It was quite extraordinary. So now, saving life or curing illness, something has to be done at once and skillfully and quickly. All right? In such circumstances, one doesn't start philosophizing, is it the good, or what will be the consequences of saving this person's life? I mention that because, you know, Hitler was blinded by poison gas, by chlorine, you know, they used to, during the First World War. And there was a doctor who was very skillful. He cured him and saved his life. See what happened afterwards. But whilst we may try to weigh the pros and the cons that way, we must remember that compassion's demand is an imperative demand. If there is real compassion, and if it is combined with deep perception and wisdom, perhaps one could cure not only the illness and save the life, but cure that person's psyche too. Then it would be a different story, wouldn't it? A man like Hitler, who had this tremendous power, this drive within himself, this vitality, if it had been directed into right channels, what a difference it might be. Our strikes today, and 12% and 20% increase every year, and all that nonsense would be clean out, wouldn't it? So there we are. You see, this question, sorting ourselves out spiritually, is really a very deep question. So, compassion's demand is imperative. Then, of course, there is the long-term situation. For example, the sad and unnecessary slaughter of animals which goes on in the world. Hundreds of millions of animals are slain all over the world for food. If you live in Greenland or right up in the mountains, high mountains in Tibet or some such place, well, one can understand. There is no other way of procuring food. But if one, at least I would, if I were to have to live in a place like that, I would just not live there. I would come down to the plains, much more sensible place to live in. You see, this food involves an immense amount of slaughter, an immense amount of actual hardship, cruelty exercised upon the animals. Look at all these battery hens and all that. Supposing I were to be put on one of these machines and just kept like that in order to fatten. One never thinks of these things, you see. And if one says, well, I don't kill the animal, but it is killed for me. And I am an accessory after the fact of, well, it's nothing short of murder. It's the intention to kill in order to eat. Well, that is the definition of murder. Not in order to eat, where human beings are concerned. That flourished in primitive days when people were cannibals. Some people were. Then there is this unnecessary slaughter in the name of sport. It's a game. It's a sport. How people can derive pleasure from destroying innocent animals, I don't know. It's extraordinary lack of sensitivity. Blood sports are a horrible thing altogether. But it's fantastic how people derive pleasure. A very dear friend of mine, whom I know very well, an intensely sensitive person, he used to enjoy watching boxing. And he said he derived a great thrill when he saw the blood spurt. Now to me, I have known him, what now? 50, well, coming on for 60 years, 58 years I've known him. But you see, how a person with such deep sensitivities, a generous person and so forth, yet there is this kind of delight in watching a blood sport. See, the blood spurting was what gave him pleasure. Or to see the other fellow knocked clean out of the ring. But you see, all these things desensitize us. And if they desensitize us, we are going against the stream of natural development, psychologically, mentally and spiritually. We are going against the stream. We are going against compassion. And then, of course, there is the slaughter due to carelessness. How many drive cars? And you know the number of car deaths which take place, accidents, is really fantastic, isn't it? The number of people who are killed by being... And of course, sometimes it's the fellow's fault. He's a jaywalker. And then Johnny Walker really deserves to be knocked down by a car. It's so inconsiderate to the driver of the car and to the car itself. You dent the car and spoil it. But people don't think of these things. They are very thoughtless. So, in this business of a long-term situation, there is the question of ecology involved. We do not live ecologically. We have not for years and years, for decades, for centuries in fact. We have plundered the earth all along the line. And if I become a business tycoon, successful, this and that, a coal magnet, a gold magnet, an iron magnet, and all the rest of it. What am I doing? I'm digging out the bowels of my mother earth, which brought me into being, and all her material and everything sustains me nurtures me, and earth will uncomplainingly take me back when I'm dead. We don't live ecologically. We don't consider the animal world, the plant world, the atmosphere in which we live. We fill it all with pollution, with horror, and so forth. So, this is another question which we have to consider carefully. Is this good work ecologically right and sound? If so, one may participate in it. But then, one has also to be careful this way. You know how vegetarians, a great many of them, their love for the animal is so great that their hate for the men who are not vegetarians is equally great. They have not a good word for the man, the living man. But this is a bit absurd. It's a bit of an unbalance, isn't it? All right, love the animal and so forth, but don't hate the man. So we have to use good sense all along the line. Now we may finally consider, is it wiser to be quiet and watchful and act as the situation or person demands or needs? If we are really quiet inside ourselves, and also where our speech and our actions are concerned, you see, if we are really quiet, and if we train ourselves to be mindful and watch exactly what's going on and so forth, a remarkable sensitivity will develop in us. We will know, and know quite rightly, that this is what the situation or the particular person needs at this moment. And we will do it straight away. We don't have to have planned compassion and all that sort of thing. These things have to happen naturally and spontaneously. And then you get the best results. Because life is of the nature of spontaneity and naturalness. That is its nature, you see. That doesn't mean that we should be unmindful of what we are doing or saying or feeling or thinking. Watch carefully. You know the way people give gratuitous advice. They're always advising someone else. You do this, that, and that, and you'll find that. You know, when I was etc., etc., and this is what happened, and I did this, and I did the other. What a pestilential, egoistic tirade comes out. Absolutely, this non-stop chattering is one of the greatest pestilences in the world. Most of it is malicious, small talk, gossip, talk which just sets one against another, a nation against a nation, and so forth. It's the first lesson in the spiritual life, the religious life, to be quiet. It is the first lesson. If one hasn't learned that, it's no good joining societies and going to meetings and listening to, marvelous speakers, and so forth, and so forth. Life itself is the most marvelous speaker. If one is quiet and listens, one will hear what is most worthwhile hearing, not otherwise. So, sorting oneself out spiritually. Yes, one must let it happen. And this ties up very much with the fulfilling of the religious desire in us. So we join this society or that society and so forth in order to fulfill our particular religious wish or whatever it may be. See, the root of all trouble is separative selfness, our isolative self-consciousness with respect to all people, and our separative self-consciousness with respect to all objects. That is absolutely the fundamental root of all the conflict and evil and war and so forth in the world. So now, if we have this isolative self-consciousness, we don't let things happen. We are always interfering, we are always barging in when we are not wanted, particularly when we are not wanted, and so forth. You see? So it is, but if we have the spirit and the decency and the natural modesty to let things happen, we will find that spiritually we'll be sorted out in double quick time. Because where the spirit is concerned, which is the context of the infinite and the immortal, the infinite and the eternal, in eternity, there is only immediacy. There is no time or succession. There is immediacy. It happens at once. And you have to let that happen. You see? You can't do anything about it as such. The transcendent is transcendent, remember. If there's a storm in the Atlantic, what are you going to do about it? You can't stop it. You can only do the sensible thing in relation to it. That is on the destructive side. But on the good side, when something good is happening, let it happen. And it will happen rightly and naturally if you are sensitive and receptive and quiet. So, let it happen as a gift of transcendence, as if by God's grace, then selfness is out. And then whatever work you do will be something good for the whole, because you yourself will radiate goodness, and by virtue of being good, you influence your total environment without your knowing it. And that is the happiest type of good work that can be done.